Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. Welcome to RTP Explainers, the latest addition to the Fourth Branch podcast series. In these short 15 to 30 minute episodes, you'll hear from experts who give you the breakdown on the complicated regulatory issues in the news. Regulation affects all of us, not just lawyers and policymakers. Tune in to get a better understanding of the rules and policies that govern us.
Hello again, this is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm pleased to welcome today two great guests to our program. The first is Ann Carlson, who is the Shirley Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA School of Law, where she is the faculty co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. She is the co-author of a top casebook on environmental law and the co-editor with Dallas Bertraw of a forthcoming book from Cambridge University Press, Lessons from the Clean Air Act, Building Durability and Flexibility into the U.S. Climate and Energy Policy. She has published numerous articles in leading law reviews and is a graduate of both UC Santa Barbara and Harvard Law School. Anne, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Our other guest today is James Coleman, who is an associate professor of law at SMU's Dedman School of Law. James is also a well-published author whose scholarship addresses environmental law and the regulation of North American energy companies. He clerked for Eighth Circuit Court Judge Stephen Palaton, and previously practiced environmental law in Washington, D.C. with Sidley Austin. He earned his BA from Harvard College and his JD from Harvard Law School. James, nice to have you with us. How are you?
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
Well, it is wonderful to have you both with us. Today's topic is the Green New Deal, and we hope you both can shed some light on this interesting and important subject. As I turn the conversation over to you both, I thought we might start off with Anne and the basic question of what is the Green New Deal and what does it propose?
Well, let me answer that question briefly and then turn it over to James. The general idea of the Green New Deal is actually to embrace a number of environmental policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that in and of themselves are not necessarily controversial. So, for example, moving to clean energy, upgrading existing buildings. I think what's controversial about the Green New Deal is really one thing that's controversial is the timetable. So the Green New Deal envisions achieving a net zero economy by 2030, and 100% clean energy by the same date. James, do you want to add anything there?
Yeah, so there, as Anne says, there are a lot of different definitions that are floating out there about what the Green New Deal is. Probably the clearest thing to do is to focus on the 14-page resolution that was filed in the House of Representatives in February. And what that does is really it's a 10-year national mobilization plan. And it focuses on really three main components. So the first is, as Anne says, that to close all fossil fuel plants, all coal, gas, and oil power plants, so that all of our electric power comes from what it calls clean, renewable, and zero-emission energy sources. The second part is to go through every other sector of the economy, transport, manufacturing, buildings, agriculture, and infrastructure, and eliminate pollution and greenhouse gas emissions as much as technologically feasible. That's the words they use. And then there's a third aspect to it, which is a variety of social and economic goals. And so probably the central promise there is that the Green New Deal will guarantee a job with a family-sustaining wage, medical leave, paid vacation, and retirement security to everyone in the United States.
Great. And with that background, I guess I'm curious for you both to weigh in. How does this proposal compare to past efforts and proposals from various administrations, Congress, and the general public?
So let me start there. I think the thing to note most dramatically here is the timetable, the ambition of the Green New Deal compared with previous proposals. It's probably worth comparing two federal proposals and at least one state proposal. Or one state law currently. So in 2009, the House of Representatives passed the only comprehensive climate legislation to pass the House of Congress. It was called the Waxman-Markey Bill. And it would have had much less dramatic reductions of greenhouse gases by really mid-2025 on the order of something like 18% reductions over a baseline. And then we have Obama administration policies. The two principal ones were the Clean Power Plan that the current president has rolled back, and standards for automobiles that have gone into effect in two phases. The second phase is currently being implemented. And as of yesterday, the Trump administration had announced that it was sending a rollback of those car standards to go through further regulatory review in anticipation of freezing the standards at 2021 levels. Both of those programs, the Obama-era programs, would have resulted in greenhouse gas emissions reductions of about 25% over 2006 levels. The Green New Deal, as James has already articulated, wants a rollback to essentially net zero carbon emissions by 2030, just 5 years later. So it's significantly more ambitious. Let me also describe the most ambitious state policy currently on the books, at least the one that's being implemented most fully, and that's in my own home state of California. California is seeking to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions first by 2020 to roll them back to 1990 levels. The state has already accomplished that goal. And then to cut another 40% compared to 1990 levels by 2030, and to get to essentially a net zero economy by 2045, so 15 years later than the Green New Deal.
Yeah, and the only thing, I agree with all that. And I guess, you know, for me, I focus on three ways that it's a little bit more ambitious than previous climate and environmental policies. You know, one is that as Anne mentioned, it's a very quick phase out of all fossil fuels. So, you know, closing every gas plant in 10 years, that's really beyond anything that's been proposed before. So you have California, which has some of the cleanest electricity in the United States, right? So they already rely a lot on renewable power. And they're looking to phase out all fossil fuels by 2045, because even those places that have clean power are still dependent on gas power plants to be back up when, you know, the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. So it's an incredibly ambitious goal to go for 100% clean energy in the next 10 years. There's two other ways, a little bit more subtle, that I think are interesting how this is different. One is, unlike a lot of other environmental legislation, this makes explicit economic goals as well. So it's not just, oh, we're going to limit the impact of this on the economy. It's, in fact, affirmative goals to improve prosperity for Americans. It says that's one of the goals that it's looking at. And this plan to guarantee a well-paid job for every person in America is a huge challenge because, you know, right now there are millions of very well-paying jobs in some of these, fossil fuel industries. And so that could, that's another way that it's more ambitious, is not only is it going to, you know, say it's going to replace those, but it's also going to provide jobs to people, well-paying jobs to people who don't currently have them. And then the last thing I think is interesting is this reliance on this term of technologically feasible. So that in every, you know, power is just 100% fossil fuel phase out. But in all the other sectors, transportation, cars, planes, trains, manufacturing, et cetera, it says it's going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as much as is technologically feasible. And that's a little bit interesting because that's not a standard that Congress has used very much in the past, technological feasibility. But when Congress did pass standards for emissions to water, emissions to air, a lot of times some people have said, well, really what they meant is as much as is technologically feasible. And the interesting thing about that is when the government has tended to, government agencies have interpreted that language and said, well, we want to reduce emissions as much as feasible, usually what they've meant by that is that without hurting polluting industry too much. So, you know, often a standard they use is, we don't want to reduce the profits of an industry by more than 10% when we consider what is feasible. And that's kind of interesting because I find it hard to believe that that's what the Green New Deal proponents are asking for, because, you know, if you just reduced the oil industry's profits 10%, really that wouldn't be that dramatic a change to U.S. energy markets. So, you know, I think the bottom line is we don't really know very much right now about how the Green New Deal would balance these kind of economic impacts of regulation versus, you know, some of its goals of reducing emissions as quickly as possible.
Let me just add a couple of points here. One, I think it's important to stress that in many respects, the Green New Deal is an aspirational document without a lot of details. So we don't actually know what the process is that would take place in order to implement the kinds of reductions that the Green New Deal calls for, what sectors would be on what kind of time frames, even the degree to which, say, states would be involved in the way that they are in many of our traditional federal environmental law programs. So in some respects, it's all we can really do is talk about the aspiration of the Green New Deal as opposed to the specifics. The other thing I want to just stress is just to highlight something that to take off on something that James said, and that is that I think what really distinguishes the Green New Deal, in addition to the ambitious time frame, is a recognition or a commitment to a transformation of the economy as we achieve our climate goals, and a recognition that those two things are intricately interwoven with one another. And given the magnitude of the changes that we need in order to reduce greenhouse gases to essentially zero, we're going to see a complete transformation of our electricity system, our energy system, our transportation system, even the way in which our industries operate. And so that's an explicit recognition that we often don't see in environmental legislation.
So one question I had is, what element of the resolution do you think is easiest to accomplish, or elements that are easiest to accomplish based on where we are at now, provided it, you know, moved from a resolution into actual legislation? And I think you've touched on this a little bit, but what do you think is the most challenging? You know, I'm originally from Detroit. I'm a car guy. The idea of getting rid of the combustion engine altogether seems like a pretty daunting task, given how many cars are on the road and that. What's the easiest to accomplish, and what might be the most challenging?
So I'm going to go back to the goals, because I think it's really the time frame that is very difficult to accomplish as opposed to the individual goals. So getting to 100% clean energy, and it's important to note that the Green New Deal says clean energy, not necessarily renewable energy. It actually sounds like a technical point, but it is actually important, because it allows for things potentially like carbon capture and sequestration for new or even existing power plants that are powered with fossil fuels. These things, I think, over a long-term horizon, I think that goal is actually achievable. I guess even speaking to folks from Detroit, the electrification of the transportation sector or the decarbonization of the transportation sector is probably possible, although heavy-duty vehicles are more difficult than passenger vehicles. But if you look at California right now, there's massive investment going on in the infrastructure necessary to electrify the vehicle fleet, and utilities are on board, and we're starting to see real penetration. The Tesla Model 3, I believe, has penetrated the top 10 cars that are being purchased by consumers. That's a big deal. One final thing I'll say, and that is that one of the goals of the Green New Deal is to get massive investment in infrastructure with climate goals in mind, including investing in a smart electric grid. That's the kind of thing that might actually garner bipartisan political support. Investment in infrastructure is something certainly that Trump has talked about, although we haven't succeeded in seeing a major infrastructure bill. But it seems like investments in, you know, big kind of national projects may be a more politically palatable thing to do than imposing a regulatory structure that requires really dramatic reductions.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that if you look at what the Democratic candidates are saying about the Green New Deal, most of the top candidates, in fact, I think everyone that's polling above 1% on average, says that they support the Green New Deal, and many of the senators have said signed on to this resolution as well. But when they say they support the Green New Deal, the things that they're often focusing the most on is those spending aspects of the Green New Deal. So, for instance, Vice President Biden says he's going to spend $1.7 trillion on investing in green infrastructure, green tech. Senator Warren says she'll spend $2 trillion on that. So I think you have a lot of emphasis on those spending provisions, and I do think that is possible. There also are, as Anne mentioned, there's a lot of aspects of the Green New Deal that are that we haven't really focused on so much, in part because they're maybe less controversial, but that are more doable. So, for instance, the one goal is to increase resiliency against climate change disasters. That'll require, of course, more infrastructure. There is also, the goal of removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere by changing soil management practices in agriculture, and also by land preservation and increasing the size of forests. So there are things like that in the Green New Deal that are that I think not only a lot of people would support, but are potentially very potentially doable. In terms of what is less doable, I think for me the two biggest things are, one, this goal of getting rid of all fossil fuel power, or maybe retrofitting with carbon capture, but basically going to 100% clean energy within 10 years. And I think it's interesting that is the one part of the Green New Deal that doesn't say it is only to the extent feasible. So that's just an ironclad commitment. Whether it's feasible or not, we're getting to 100% clean energy. And that, I haven't seen a plausible analysis of how that could be done. Let's say that as a first step, you wanted to get more wind power from the Midwest, where we have such great wind resources, basically from Texas to North Dakota. You wanted to get those to places that don't have wind power. Well, so you need to build a power line. The average permitting time for these power lines is over 10 years. So how you're going to go from a system where it takes us 10 years to build a power line to a system where we're going to completely remake our electricity grid in 10 years, I just haven't seen an analysis of how that could be done. The second part that I think it's hard to see how it could be done is this guarantee of a high-paying job with benefits for every American. The reality is that reducing pollution costs money, and it can be a very good investment and completely worth it given the impacts of pollution on people. But it does cost money, because it means replacing old systems that are heating your house, or it means buying a new car, or it means closing down old power plants and building new ones, building new power lines, et cetera. So, it's hard for me to see how they're going to guarantee everybody a high-paying job.
Look, I'd like to raise a sort of broader philosophical question, and that is about the setting of highly ambitious goals that may or may not be feasible, which is related to James' last point. And take us back 50 years now to when the Clean Air Act was adopted in 1970. The Clean Air Act is arguably the most successful federal environmental statute we have. The cleanup of the air over the course of the last 50 years has been quite extraordinary, even in the face of increases in population, huge increase in economic growth, and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and really, and it's true not only of the Clean Air Act, but the Clean Water Act, when it was passed, one of the goals was to completely eliminate all, at the very start of the bill, it wants to completely eliminate all discharges to water by 1985. And, you know, we're not, we didn't eliminate them in 1985. And, well, you know, there's no prospect that we'll really eliminate them ever, but there's no question that the Clean Water Act has led to, you know, much cleaner water and a lot of benefits, and that, you know, as in the air case, sometimes there were things that seemed impossible at the time that we've come up with new technologies and have made them possible. Now, I think that's absolutely important. I would say that there is a flip side, which is that, you know, it's not just the case that Congress can mandate anything and somehow industry will find a way to meet it, even if it's a couple of years late. You know, I think of the example, because I think sometimes Congress can feel like, well, you know, industry always tells us that they can't do this, but there must be a way. You know, one counterexample is when the Renewable Fuel Standard was passed in 2007. Congress said that, you know, by now, most ethanol that was sold in the United States should be, or at least a substantial percentage, shouldn't be coming from corn anymore. It should be coming from advanced biofuels that were made from just wastes, grasses, from, you know, wood waste, et cetera, things that, you know, didn't require a lot of intense agriculture. And so, you know, Congress basically looked at the complaints from industry that that wasn't possible. They didn't know how to do that. And Congress just said, well, we're going to mandate it. You always find a way. And, you know, unfortunately what's happened is that no one has found a way to do that. And so we don't really have anything. I mean, you know, we have less than 1% of the cellulosic biofuel that was mandated by Congress. Nobody's figured out how to produce it. And so as a result, we're relying more on, you know, traditional ethanol that has some real environmental downsides. So in any event, I think it is absolutely true that often ambitious goals push us, can push to achieve things that might have seemed impossible, but they can also have some potential downsides. If you look at, you know, the Clean Air Act, because a lot of these standards depended on, you know, whether you want to call it feasibility or achievability, look at the different standards that are or available technologies, the different standards set under the Clean Air Act. They were typically defined in a way that it wasn't going to really shut down any American, any major American industries. So, you know, as Anne describes, basically the automakers were given more time when they couldn't meet these standards. I think one of the difficulties with the challenges with climate regulation in general and the Green New Deal is that to be effective, if it's going to achieve its goal, it actually has to shut down some major U.S. industries. The U.S. is the world's leading producer of both oil and gas. You know, it's currently going through the biggest oil boom, biggest commodity boom that the world has ever seen. And so, you know, if the Green New Deal is going to be successful, it can't just get oil and gas companies to change their behavior a little bit. You know, it's actually, or to come up with new technology to clean up their act, it may have to shut down some of those major industries. And I think that makes it a little bit different challenge than those Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act statutes.
I just want to quote some testimony that Lee Iacocca, who just died, but who was the one of the most famous auto executives, probably after Henry Ford, gave to Congress in 1970 when the Clean Air Act amendments were being considered. He said, "The levels for 1975 models are lower than any we know how to meet. If such levels are established, the technology as we know it today would not permit us to continue to produce cars after January 1, 1975. Okay,
yeah.
So we had the same kinds of claims.
Absolutely.
At that time. Here's what a pollution control officer in Los Angeles said in 1971. Even if you depopulated Los Angeles County, stripped it of all its people, automobiles, industries, everything, we still couldn't meet some of the EPA standards. So the idea that the Green New Deal is somehow unique in calling for really dramatic transformation of the way in which industry operates is somewhat belied by what was being said at the time of the Clean Air Act. And I think it's true that one of the responses to the ambition of the Clean Air Act was to loosen it around the edges. But it wasn't to just say, we're just going to let you do what you can with existing technology or what's technologically feasible. It was instead to push for new technology. And the catalytic converter is a very good example of that. It did not exist in its current form at the time the Clean Air Act was passed. It was really rudimentary. It had never been mass produced. It could only be used with, rather, it couldn't be used with the gasoline that was available at the time, that's leaded gasoline. And industry adapted. And so I think part of what the Green New Deal is trying to do is to push hard now to confront what is, after all, the greatest existential environmental crisis we have ever faced, and to get industry to innovate. So it may be that the oil and gas industry innovates by figuring out how to capture emissions, by figuring out how to reduce methane or eliminate methane from fracking operations. You're not going to get that kind of technological innovation unless the government requires that kind of innovation through very stringent regulatory programs or through a price on carbon or through a cap and trade program, something that causes industry actually to take into account in its operations the environmental damage its emissions are causing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it is interesting, there is definitely a problem that the industry has, which is the, you know, boy who cried wolf problem, which is to say, how are we supposed to take these arguments seriously about the cost this will impose on industry if in the past you told us things were going to be terrible and in fact they weren't. I mean, Lee Iacocca, he said, you know, the Clean Air Act could prevent continued production of automobiles and was a threat to the entire American economy and to every person in America. And, you know, I think one way to see if companies, how serious a problem companies view some regulation as is to look at what they were telling investors. You know, if you look at what Lee Iacocca was telling his investors at the same time, he was saying that the auto industry has survived and grown, even in countries that have government policies that make owning a car much more difficult than it is in the United States. So he has no doubt that it will continue to grow. So I think, you know, I think we need to be careful when we hear these complaints to look to what these companies are telling, you know, their investors about, not just what they're saying in public, not just what they're saying to regulators, but, you know, how big of a concern would some of these bills be for them? And, and I think what the two options that Anne mentioned there about are both about pricing carbon and making sure that that was cap and trade and a carbon tax. And both of those, what they do is they ensure that those fossil fuel companies pay for the damages that they impose on the public. They pay for the damages they impose on the climate. And I think what's important to understand is that's a way of balancing, ensuring that companies pay for the damage they impose is a way of making sure that we don't, that we balance sort of economic and environmental concerns. Because it says, look, if you're going to have to pay for that environmental damage you cause. Now, I think the tricky thing with the Green New Deal is we don't yet know how it's going to how people would implement this in terms of balancing those economic and environmental concerns. Are they going to say, well, as long as you're paying for the pollution that you're imposing, that's going to be enough, or is that, you know, as sort of the text of the resolution suggests, is the idea we're getting to 100% clean energy no matter what?
The other thing at this point is it's not Green New Deal is just a resolution. It's a
right.
set of goals and suggestions. It's not even a proposed bill or legislation. So it certainly remains to be seen how any of it would be implemented legislatively. you know, I think we're going to have an opportunity to talk about this many times over in the months and years to come. I'm wondering if maybe you could offer us some thoughts or final reflections.
Sure. So one thought that I think is a really important one, and one that is not encapsulated by the Democratic candidate's position on the Green New Deal, is what is politically feasible? And right now, you know, a number of members of Congress still don't even acknowledge the existence of climate change, let alone have shown an interest in regulating the greenhouse gases that cause it. That's not to say that the political landscape isn't changing. So one thing I think is really interesting about the Green New Deal is I think it's part of a broader movement we're seeing where the public, for the first time, is very worked up about climate change. That wasn't true even in 2016 for our last presidential election, where the candidates barely spoke about climate change. I don't think there was a single question asked about climate change in the debates. We're seeing voters, particularly on the Democratic side, say that climate change is one of their defining issues in choosing a candidate. And we're also starting to see young Republicans in particular want to demand action out of their party. And so that's a real change. And we're seeing it, I think, in these youth movements around the world. Again, I think the Green New Deal really encapsulates some of that. That being said, the feasibility of what you can get through Congress remains a very big challenge and a very big question. And so one thing that we ought to be looking at, I think, over the course of the next several years is what are various presidential candidates likely to do with executive authority? Because all of the climate policy that came out of the Obama administration, or at least most of it, was done through existing regulatory authority the administration had under the Clean Air Act. That same authority exists for the Trump administration and, in fact, may require the Trump administration to take some action on climate change that so far it hasn't been willing to do. So it's a really complicated question, actually, what we're going to see come out of Washington over the course of the next 3 to 5 years on climate policy as the politics move, as, you know, we may see a change in administration. We don't know what's going to happen in 2020. We don't know what the congressional makeup will be, both in the House and the Senate. And we don't also know what the Supreme Court will tolerate in the way of executive action on climate change. So there are a lot of really complex moving parts here. And the Green New Deal, I think, is important because it's shifted our conversation, but it remains to be seen how much it actually shifts our policy.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. And I do think, you know, it is important to go through each of the, you know, 22 candidates and say, well, what part is going to which parts require Congress, which parts could maybe get through Congress, and which parts would be changed a lot. And I think that the Green New Deal is no doubt one, because this is not really an executive action way of implementing most of this. And so I think that means that pretty much any Green New Deal that actually went into practice is going to be something that's going to be completely changed by the Congress, and may depend on if the Senate flipped Democrat, does it maintain the filibuster, or does it get rid of it? I do think the spending things are a little bit more interesting, because sometimes presidents can get some spending, since there has to be a budget every year and everybody's going to have to vote for it. That might be a little bit easier to push through Congress. And then I think, probably the most important things to focus on, are the executive actions that people have promised. And I think, you know, if you look through the plans, you know, for instance, Vice President Biden has a whole series of executive actions that he's promised to take. And I think those are the ones that are, you know, that the president could do by him or herself, and they are also the ones that, you know, I think there'll be a lot of pressure to go through with those ones, if only because some of the other promises are going to run up into Congress. And I think that's a dynamic that we saw a lot of the time with President Obama was that, well, if you know he wasn't getting through Congress, tried to get the American Clean Energy and Security Act, the Waxman-Markey, through Congress, it passed the House, didn't pass the Senate. And so there was a lot of pressure on President Obama to act in other ways that he could do based on, with purely executive action. And I think that had something to do with, the Keystone XL pipeline being blocked. It had something to do, with the course that the Clean Power Plan took. And so I think you will probably see a lot of you would see a lot of pressure, so it's particularly important to focus on those executive actions at the moment.
Well, I think this has been an excellent conversation. We really appreciate your insights today. I'm very confident that we will be discussing the Green New Deal going forward, and we look forward to having you join us again. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.